Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 12 minutes after 9 o'clock, time to begin this morning's panel discussions on topics in the news. Joining us this morning, our pal Rosemary Armeo, Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, and always fun to, read the email.
Pal. Eh?
Pro and con. Well, if okay. I don't call you a pal, I could be in for trouble over the next 48 minutes. So, yes, for now, you're my pal. Chief of Capital New York's Albany Bureau, Jimmy Vielkind is here. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Great.
Made it here by the skin of your teeth, but nice to have you here this morning. All right. You have plenty of you probably had no sleep this week.
You know, it's been a long week. Felt like a Friday yesterday.
I'm going to give you a chance to decompress with some national and international news first before we get
to... Imagine that being the easy stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's not an easy start. And if you watched, I think they carried this live on CNBC. I don't know what other news outlets were carrying it. We were watching it yesterday. General Motors came under harsh criticism on Capitol Hill Tuesday as CEO Mary Barra went before members of Congress investigating a botched GM recall. This is from CNN Money. Barra, appearing before a House committee, apologized for the 13 deaths that GM says were caused by a faulty ignition switch, as well as GM's 10-year delay in issuing a recall. That February recall has grown to 2.6 million vehicles worldwide. Members from both sides of the aisle attacked both General Motors and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the federal safety regulator. And the news in the New York Times says GM has now hired a lawyer specializing in disaster payouts. They are now for the first time indicating that they will be paying out. Rosemary.
Well, it's I keep thinking as I'm watching this that GM is one of the big giant companies that we're trying to give more rights to. You know, they have First Amendment rights and religious freedom rights, and big companies need to be controlled and regulated. That did not happen in GM. The piece that caused these deaths and other damage too, not just the deaths, was worth something between 57 and 90 cents each to fix. And they chose not to, and then very cynically realized that when they went into bankruptcy, they could get out of any sort of a legal obligation for damage and death.
Yeah.
Very cold-blooded. And what they're doing now is absolutely what they have to do. She gave very pretty speech. She was very careful not to go over the line. She said, we have a lawyer, one very famous for handing out pass, but she didn't say we're going to hand out any money, because actually she's not legally obligated to pay out for a lot of them. She's making nice. We're going to get to the bottom of things. Yes, I want to know too. She did not give any real answers as to how this could have happened. Engineers appear to have known what was going on. And it was a cold...
For quite a while.
Yeah. Cold-blooded, money-calculating reason to not fix it.
I think they said that there was no business rationale for doing the recall.
Yeah, other than, like, you kill your customers and they're sort of angry about it, you know?
One thing that was striking to me was, you know, Ms. Barra is... First of all, she's the first woman to lead a big automaker in the United States. And I think she's been on the job less than a year now. And so having a fresh face coming in... It is almost the most logical corporate strategy to say, okay, we're turning the page. She apologized. You know, the headline here is, I am deeply sorry, to turn the page, to try and move beyond exactly what's happened. And if you had had the same executive team in place that had been on the watch while this was going on, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Absolutely, so but she did not give the satisfaction of even blaming the team that came before her or explaining what the heck they could have been thinking about. She protected GM right down the line.
And some interesting parts of the testimony yesterday. And again, I'll quote CNN Money here. Why a substandard part was used. Many questions fired at Barra focused on the faulty ignition switch that GM installed in cars, despite knowing it did not meet its own company specifications. Here's the interesting part. Barra explained that just because the part did not meet specifications does not mean it's defective. Go figure.
It sounds like lawyer talk to me.
Yeah.
It just sounded totally like lawyer talk, the whole thing. She could not say anything else.
Well, and this, you know, Rosemary, you alluded to this a moment ago. We have an era where government has been is being scaled back, and where there's talk about, you know, there's a very big push about government overreach and government overregulation.
Correct.
And, you know, this is sort of the flip argument to that. You know, they talk about, well, the government's always regulating everything business does, and then something like this happens, and there are cries, again, as we were pointing out, from both parties. Where was the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration?
Board. Yeah, they actually looked very bad, I thought, in the hearings. Like, why didn't you know there's like a wealth of material that they received, complaints, all kinds of descriptions. They could easily have gotten to this much sooner than was gotten to.
Right.
And they chose not to. The head of the committee just said, well, we just didn't have enough proof.
Right. And I know when this comes up in various levels, it comes up in New York, it comes up on the national level, most business folks will tell you, well, whatever the rules are, whatever the regulator is, like, let it be. We want a strong regulator. Because, you know, would GM have preferred to deal with this as it snowballed, or would they prefer to get a regulator who said, no, do the recall
do
now.
Do it right now.
Eat a couple million.
There would have been a lot fewer cars to be recalled had it been handled early on also.
And we're talking about a part that, to put a one that was not, how does she put it, meeting company specifications, but not defective, to put a better version of that part in would have cost 90 cents more per vehicle.
Yeah, that's
what we're talking about.
I've seen
about
figures
here.
That went from 57 to 90 cents.
Yeah,
so under a dollar range. Each, right.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing yesterday was the news that no one at GM lost their job over the faulty part.
Well,
it's just
astonishing. All right, moving on. It's I'll tell you what, take a break here. It's the Roundtable at WAMC. We love to hear from you. Roundtable@WAMC.org. Roundtable@WAMC.org. We'll take a break, shift gears, and be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. River Valley Market, Northampton, Massachusetts, a food co-op featuring fresh local foods, a deli department with made-to-order sandwiches, a soup and salad bar, and a bakery, rivervalleymarket.coop. And St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com.
Nice. That's Mr. Hopper picking the music today on the Roundtable. 19 minutes after 9 o'clock, Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's our panel. The panel today is our pal Rosemary Armeo and our pal Jimmy Vielkind from Capital New York. And we switch here. Big day for the Affordable Care Act. Obama claims victory in push for insurance. This from the New York Times. President Obama declared victory Tuesday in the government's aggressive push to enroll 7 million people in private health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act, even as his senior aides braced for an escalated political battle over the law ahead of the fall's crucial midterm elections. In a Rose Garden ceremony, Mr. Obama announced that a late surge of customers to healthcare.gov before Monday's deadline had pushed insurance signups to 7.1 million, slightly more than the administration's final goal. The achievement was somewhat remarkable considering the bureaucratic and technical nightmare that surrounded the website's debut last October. And again, that's quoting from the New York Times. Rosemary.
Okay, I'll start. Jimmy and I were just saying how rich this is. We have about four articles from different publications today assessing all this. So here's how I see it. Obama got the minimum necessary he needed to go on, but his battle is not won. This is not a big victory for him. He got basically the minimum number he needed to say, okay, look, we did it. We overcame the problems and we're going to change things. But some of the questions that remain and that you can be sure Republicans and conservatives are picking out are, who are the people who signed up? Are these people who simply were bounced out of their previous plans? Or are they people who are signing up for extended Medicaid, which is completely different than getting people who are uninsured onto the rolls? And are they people who will pay their premiums, their sign-ups? And the president specifically said we had people sign up, not that they're paying. Without money coming in, this will all fall apart. There remain big problems with the program, both signing them up and forcing now the next step after the sign-up period is people who didn't sign up, who should have, who don't have insurance. Are we going to start fining them? Will that happen?
And, that's a question.
And what's coming up in the elections is that I don't think Obama has a big Democratic majority in either house that he's going to rely on to protect this program.
Right. And you know, putting aside the politics for just a few moments, you know, there are big questions about this $7 million figure, which was kind of the standard, as you said, the bare minimum. You know, a study by the RAND Corporation finds that approximately only one third of those exchange signups were previously uninsured. And this is something that the right wing was very quick to tout as the president was trying to declare victory here.
So in other words, you're moving people from one plan to another. That's different than signing up people who had not been on any plan.
Right. And of course, there are people who made a really big show of, I had an individual insurance plan, not purchased through an employer, not purchased through a group, but just, you know, me, Mr. Smith, talking to insurance company X. And those essentially went away under Obamacare. Mm-hmm. So to what extent is this an expansion? And then, Rosemary, you brought up the great point of, are these people going to pay and what type of insurance are they getting? Here in New York, there's actually been a great, you could argue, a very big success, a bright spot for Obamacare and for the enrollment. New York's Health Exchange was humming along the entire time. Enrollments have moved at a good clip. But I think at least half, perhaps even a little bit more than half, have been for the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, listeners remember that what this did was, when we had this exchange, we expanded the eligibility for Medicaid, which is the subsidized state federal health insurance program, so that you know, previously ineligible people may now fall into eligibility categories. But that's a little bit different than just getting and broadening the private insurance base, which health experts say needs to happen if long-term costs are going to go down. And then the people who they want to enroll are people who are going to pay premiums but not be heavy users.
Right, they're going to be who young are the people.
And that's what they say is the key to the success of the whole thing.
They have to pay in, but they're frankly, they're not going to probably get their money's worth immediately.
Correct.
And the hope is that those people will kind of lock into the system, make it as close to a single-payer, broad-based system as can possibly be for the numbers to really work out.
For it to work for everybody, which is another Obama promise, that this isn't just to help poor people. It's going to make healthcare affordable and more sustainable for everyone. The other thing I find remarkable are the difference in signups between those states like New York, as you mentioned.
Great point. We've been very aggressive in California.
Right. And you take a look at, say, Oklahoma and West Virginia, I looked at, there were like virtually no signups. I mean, it's as if it doesn't even exist. So if you're Republican candidates who are trying to get rid of health care, which Paul Ryan has on the record as saying, yes, he wants to do that, as are many others, that's where you're going to start.
Before you go, Jim, interesting that Representative Nancy Pelosi of California, and again quoting here the New York Times, the Democratic leader said she did not think the health care law would be the decisive issue in this year's midterm elections, regardless of the intensity of the attacks leveled by Republicans. She said, I never said that we would run on it.
Yeah.
That's a lie.
Republicans really, if you talk to any Republican congressional candidate, and over the past months, the ones that I've been talking to, they see this as the defining issue of this election cycle. If you talk to a guy like Chris Gibson, or a Republican hopeful like Lee Stefanik, or an incumbent Republican like Tom Reed, they all say that this law is now coming together, and they say that it's becoming tangible for people. They're talking about people who have lost coverage or who have had to shift coverage in a way that maybe makes them unhappy. They're talking about premiums that are at perhaps a higher level than they were earlier. The Republicans will be running on this issue again, as signaled, Ray, as you said, by Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican who was the vice presidential nominee in the past election cycle.
And a presidential contender again.
Mm-hmm. Democrats are trying to change the subject. I don't know how successful they're going to be.
Are they scared? Are they that scared?
They should be.
I don't know if it's scared. You know, I talked to Congressman Paul Tonko, who represents the Albany area, about this a couple of weeks ago, and he was actually, as you said, Rosemary, pushing. He was at an event that was designed to push people to sign up for Obamacare. He's happy to own Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, however you want to describe it.
Right.
And he says, if you look at the long-term projections, if you look at what's happening, and the fact that there are people who were uninsured who are now getting health care, now getting health insurance. There are some points in this law that perhaps have an element of political popularity to them. The idea of letting younger people continue on their parents' insurance. And the Democrats can point to the Republicans and say, well, what is your alternative?
Do you have an alternative? I think Pelosi knows all of this, and it was disingenuous to say we're not going to run on it. She knows quite well that that's not going to be the case. And I also think that Republicans have not been very successful in pointing out problems. People have been cheated. And it's interesting, the New York Times right now in their article on this has a little ad, did you say, a little kind of in-house ad, asking that, we want to hear about your experience with Obamacare. If you've had problems, let us know.
Right.
People are looking for them. A number of ads that Republicans have put out have been disclaimed. They were not true.
But even if the Democrats don't run on this proactively, and I think Congresswoman Pelosi is correct. I don't think this is something, if I were a Democratic candidate or that I'm hearing from Democratic candidates, that they'd want to bring up proactively. But think about what they are trying to change the subject. They've been talking. Think about the president's State of the Union speech this year, talking about a minimum wage increase, talking about college affordability.
And mentioning this as a
side
thing.
They keep trying to move on
Isn't that a mistake the Democrats frequently make, though, is that they simply do not own up to the good in the policies they have? They become incredibly defensive.
Well, I think that if it turns out to be a rousing success, you will see a quick turn of a strategy there. All right, we only have about 2 minutes here. I wanted to touch on this topic with both of you specifically, and I think we'll take it up on the other side of the news. By the way, the email address here is roundtable@wamc.org. This, don't turn off the radio, folks, this is from the National Review, James Capretta. Now, an interesting question that I'll pose to our journalists, and then we'll take a break. You can mull it over. The Obamacare open enrollment season closed yesterday, so it's a good time to step back and assess where things stand with the law and its first-year implementation. Interestingly, Obamacare remains something of a Rorschach test for journalists and health policy analysts. Looking at the same set of facts, two observers can reach very different conclusions. For instance, Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times writes that Obamacare has, quote, spurred the largest expansion in health care coverage in America in half a century. Meanwhile, health consultant Howard J. Peterson, writing at the Philadelphia Inquirer news site, says, quote, the first 4 years of Obamacare has led to solving about 10% of the problem of uninsured citizens. He expects no further improvement. So which is it? And you know what? You don't have time to answer right now, Rosemary or Jimmy. So I want you to think about
mull
that.
Mull it over.
And is, in fact, the media playing a key role in all of this, success or failure? And what we'll do is we'll take a break right now. We'll get some news and whatnot. The Roundtable is the show. Jimmy Vielkind is here, Rosemary Armeo, our pal, and Ray Graff here in for Joe Donahue. You can email us, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Wednesday morning. 9:36 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Rosemary Armeo is here. Jimmy Vielkind is here. And we discussed before the news an article by James Capretta, who is a fellow. He's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And the question he raised was, well, I'll reread the first couple of short paragraphs here. The Obamacare open enrollment season closed yesterday, so it's a good time to step back and assess where things stand with the law and its first-year implementation. Interestingly, Obamacare remains something of a Rorschach test for journalists and health policy analysts. Looking at the same set of facts, two observers can reach very different conclusions. For instance, Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times writes that Obamacare has, quote, spurred the largest expansion in health care in America in half a century. Meanwhile, health consultant Howard Peterson, writing at the Philadelphia Inquirer, says the first 4 years of Obamacare has led to solving about 10% of the problem of uninsured citizens. And the question is, which is it? And the bigger question is, given the same set of facts and two sort of different outlooks, how does a journalist toe the line and get the facts when whatever you say will be in some instance interpreted politically by those on the other side? Jimmy, you go first.
Well, the number is the number. So you present the number and then you talk about how people who are inclined to agree with the law take that, and you talk about people who are inclined to disagree with the law take that. We were just talking a little bit over the break. You know, I think that a lot of journalists, I don't know if it, you could argue that it is a Rorschach test in some respects, because of course the coverage and the sensibility on this topic has been very partisan, and it has been very stark. But I think people who are close to government, people who deal every day with government, and I would include myself in this category, things don't happen overnight. That's just not how our government works. It's actually not how our government has really ever worked. There are very, very few things that the government, the state, the federal, the local government does that are just quick and binary. And especially on big issues such as trying to grapple with healthcare costs, things take time. Things do take time. So, you know, Obama didn't say that this was going to happen overnight. I don't think that the law's most ardent supporters said that it was going to happen overnight. They certainly did set benchmarks. They certainly did roll out a timeline where they said progress would be made. And it doesn't seem in some instances that they've correctly hit that timeline. But I think that there's probably a little bit of deference. I know I would give a little bit of deference to the fact that things are happening. So 10% of the uninsured are now covered. Okay. As opposed to 0% of the uninsured who are not covered. So I think that there's a way to do it objectively. I think that, that good reporters are going to be doing it objectively. But I also think that
are going to be doing it objectively, and they're going to be ignored by partisans on both sides, because Republicans want to say right now it failed. Democrats want to say right now, oh, no, it's working great. And neither one of those two things we know is true. I think Capretta and this article gives a good shot at how a good journalist does it, which is that both of these statements are true. Right. It is a historic movement forward in health care, and it also in 4 years, I would dispute that whether 4 years it's really been in operation. You've been trying to operationalize it in that time. But in 4 years, only 10% of the problem has been solved. That's a long way to go. Both of those things are objectively true and the most realistic. Just isn't very satisfying.
Well, you know, you have the Krauthammers of the world saying the numbers yesterday were basically bogus. The 7 million were okay. So
much looked at. Yeah,
okay. And there are those on both sides who say these things. Now, as a journalist close to state government, and Rosemary, I'll throw it out to you as a theoretical question. If you're covering government, whatever government, closely, and you put out positive information, information that the government says, okay, here's the good news that we have for you, then are you in fact in danger of having your finger pointed at you and say, well, you're just a propagandist working with the government?
Well, sure. Jimmy will answer this, too. Of course you're in danger of that. The Washington Post did this really well today. They took a look at that 7 million number. Where did they come up with it? Harry Reid had used 10 million. Another number was 9. And they looked at all those numbers. They did a piece about the numbers. It was really kind of fascinating.
Right.
And 7 is about right.
Right. And so once you take that, you can talk about what's behind it, and you could talk about how it's being treated. If there are people who are criticizing it, who say, as we've seen and presented here, hey, according to the RAND Corporation, only one third of this 7 million represents new people with insurance. Point that out.
Right.
If there are people like the president who say this validates our work, we take this moving forward, it hits our benchmark, then you point that out as well.
And then you point out that Paul Ryan wants to dump the whole thing in his proposed budget.
Oh, yes. And we were going to discuss that, and we will cover that in a moment. But let's go let's go to Albany, and Jimmy Vielkind of Capital New York has had a busy week, quite clearly. And yesterday was something of a victory lap for Governor Cuomo and lawmakers.
That's right. So New York State has passed a budget, $137.9 billion, billion with a B, and it was on time for the fourth year in a row. And that's really big, and that's something that a lot of the elected leaders, particularly and especially New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, wanted to emphasize for everybody. Four budgets in a row, the governor had little baseballs and a little baseball icon and said, a grand slam,
yeah.
Four.
Thought he was at Denny's for a while there when I was
watching
that.
You're not the only one who brought that up.
Yeah.
He said last year it was three, it was a hat trick, and I don't know what comes in fives. But, you know, if we have to get to a
one
five.
One for the thumb, right? That would be the old Super Bowl, you know, the Steelers, they get the ring, one for the thumb.
Ray, we're going to write that down. Okay. We're going to break that out next April.
Dear Governor Cuomo, I have an idea for you.
But so this state budget does a lot of things. It's definitely an election year budget, as one of my colleagues in the Capitol Press Corps, Tom Precious at the Buffalo News, put oh so eloquently and clearly. this budget does a lot of things that Governor Cuomo particularly needs it to do, including a system of property tax rebate checks that are going to go to basically suburban homeowners. People who live outside the city of New York will be getting some sort of rebate based on whether or not their municipality hits the state's 2% property
and
tax.
And how many
cap.
Of those municipalities do you forecast will actually hit that 2%?
I think probably all of them will find some way to do so this year. But we'll see.
Interesting leverage, though.
It's very interesting leverage. And the whole idea here on behalf of Governor Cuomo was, and he insists that this is not an election year gimmick. There are critics on both the right and the left who say that this is an election year gimmick, that elected leaders are just trying to do this to boost their own political standing. On the right, they say it's a tax shift. You're using state money, which comes mostly from income taxes, and you're sending it to people who mostly pay property taxes. On the left, they criticize the program. They say that the people who are going to get the biggest rebates are the ones who pay the most property taxes, and they pay the most property taxes usually because their homes are worth the most, and their homes are worth the most because they make the most money, because they live in places like Chappaqua where they can have a high-paying job. And so why are you giving the most benefit to the people who have that? So there are critiques of this on both the left and the right. But the argument that Cuomo and the supporters of this program make is that it is going to show relief, and it's going to try and force a conversation among municipalities, among counties and cities and villages and school districts and towns to see how they can more efficiently operate, to see how they can share services, to see if perhaps if we look at our own Albany County, do we really need to have, I think it's 6 or 7 police dispatching entities?
Well, can't the consolidation one person do that? Have not been all that successful.
They have not been all that successful. And part of it is people say, oh, the numbers don't really add up to very much. But part of it is, okay, when we talk about consolidation efforts, let's stay with this police dispatching example, because it's something that seems fairly logical from a perspective. You're talking about job cuts. People are going to lose their jobs. And then the other question is, well, I want control. I am the mayor of Smithtown, and I want to be able to walk down the hall and know that my police dispatcher is someone who's solid, who I can trust. I don't know that I feel comfortable having some guy off in La La Land doing that police dispatching for me. So this program is set up to try and facilitate that conversation. Now, it has been watered down from what the governor originally proposed. Originally, the governor said citizens are only going to get these checks if the spending in their local government goes down. That was beaten back, mostly after pressure from municipal unions and from the associations of towns and counties and the Conference of Mayors, who said, no, this isn't realistic. This isn't fair. So, this project, it's again, it gets back to the point we were just making. This idea of local government spending and the structure of local government in New York is a huge problem. And Ray, you and I have talked about it on these very airwaves many, many, many times before. But what the heck are you going to do about it, right? You can't just drop a nuclear bomb and blow it up, because it's correct. If we were to design government right now in 2014, it would look very different than the way we designed government starting in some cases, the 17th century here in upstate New York, and just sort of layered and kind of kept going over time. So it's a big deal. Other aspects.
Can I interrupt? I want you to talk a little bit about education in here, education in the budget.
That's a great point. And also the education, pre-K, the de Blasio, right. Cuomo
fight.
Equation, we'll say. I'll tell you what.
Situation.
Fight, equation, situation. Now, let's take a break. It's the Roundtable on WAMC. You can email us at roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Deerfield Cabinets, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing all wood cabinets, granite countertops, and other built-to-order options for kitchen, bathroom, and throughout the home. DeerfieldCabinets.com. And Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, April 12th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's our Roundtable panel on a Wednesday. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Rosemary Armeo is here. Jimmy Vielkind from Capital New York is here. And we've been talking a little about state government in New York, but certainly a topic that carries forth across state lines, and that's the problem, the question of education. And what have we done anything on that this week?
We had another, that was the other big takeaway from this year's state budget. Again, $137.9 billion adopted, signed into law on Monday, just before the April 1 deadline. This budget increases aid to schools. And I can tell you that forever and ever, no matter where you are, there are going to be people who say, we need more money for schools, more money for schools, more money for schools. And so that was certainly the dynamic this year. And the state budget increases funding by about $1.1 billion. And it gets it up, that's about a 5.3% increase. So I think that's about $22 billion overall that we, the New York State government, send to our school districts. And the other thing it does is it sets up funding for a statewide system of universal pre-kindergarten. That is a solid academic-based approach for four-year-olds before they get into the traditional kindergarten as five-year-olds.
Is that a win for de Blasio?
Well, yes, it's the big macro politics here are that New York City's new Democratic mayor, Bill de Blasio, and we've talked about this before, he really wanted this. He ran on this. And what his plan was, hey, Albany, state government, let me, New York City mayor, raise taxes on the rich. I'm going to take the money, about $300 million per year, and I'm going to put it in pre-K in the city. State leaders, including Governor Cuomo, a fellow Democrat who often emphasizes how close and happy and fun he is with how lovely he and the mayor get along, said, you know, I don't think we should be raising taxes. The governor doesn't want taxes to go up under his watch. He thinks it's bad for his own politics, and he thinks it's bad and as he tries to cozy up to sort of traditional Republican donors, traditional Republican constituencies, and position himself as sort of that Clintonian, Solomonic centrist, call it whatever you will.
So he found another way.
He found $300 million lying under carpets and couch cushions, et cetera. The state budget is very complex and fungible. And the way this is going to be set up is it's a reimbursement plan. So theoretically, this pot of money, it's $340 million overall, is going to be available to districts around the state. But the way they did it was they estimated New York City will need $300 million. And essentially, the state leaders, including Governor Cuomo, are daring de Blasio to say, okay, you say you can do it. You say you can spend $300 million this fall. Go ahead, buddy. Go ahead. This is not the end. You're going to see continued clashes over is he doing it, et cetera, because, you know, the governor is probably a little bit pugnacious in his nature. That's his natural state. And he's going to want to keep pushing on this
point. Jimmy, is there anything in this budget that Cuomo did not want?
Is there anything in
this
budget?
I love how the legislators call it a compromise.
How about
the compromise means there must be something in there he didn't want.
How about the step back from teacher evaluations?
There is no step back. You're bringing up a sort of different. Let me try and do Rosemary's question first, and
okay,
then I'll get into the common core stuff a little bit. I can't think of anything in this budget that really, really makes the governor cry at night. Mm-hmm. I can't think of anything like that. There are things that legislators inserted. There are things where they modified a gubernatorial proposal. But there's nothing that I can look at here that is really a shocking defeat for the governor. It's just a question of someone else pushing a priority in. Some of Cuomo's proposals on taxes were modified. His changes to the estate tax were modified and scaled back a bit. His changes to the corporate tax went through unscathed. And legislators, for example, Long Island Republicans really pushed for that extra school aid, which the governor, you know, tried to hold the line on. The Republicans from in the Senate really also pushed to expand a manufacturing credit statewide. Those are their wins. In the Assembly, they moved back the estate tax. They pushed for that aid. And they pushed really for this pre-K funding. But no big defeats.
Mm.
Now, Ray brings up that great can of worms for any parent of any school-aged child, including parents who are probably listening and have kids right at this very moment taking Common Core-based tests.
ELA is going on right
That's
now.
That's right. The ELA exam is going on right now. I think it's 4th through 8th graders are taking these tests.
Yeah, or third. Is it 3rd or 4th?
Might even be 3rd.
I think it's 3rd, yeah.
3rd through 8th graders are taking this test. Recognizing that there is unrest among parents, all of whom are voters, Republicans, Democrats, Socialists, Conservatives, etc., about these tests, this budget essentially, as the governor says, pushes the pause button. The tests that are being taken right now for students do not count. They will not appear on the permanent records. They will not harm little Susie's chances of going to Harvard or MIT or RPI or wherever.
But the question
is, well, what does it mean for teachers? Because under new systems of evaluation, our state teachers are in part evaluated based on test scores, and these are the test scores, which parents are shocked about. So this budget does not do anything for teachers. However, state leaders, including Governor Cuomo, for the first time on Tuesday, said that there would be adjustments to the teacher evaluation system based on these concerns over the Common Core tests. What are the adjustments? It's unclear as of now. And that's something that's going to be hashed out and negotiated, theoretically, before the state legislature leaves in June. But this is becoming a really big political issue. And that's one of the reasons I think you're seeing a spur to action by the governor, who had previously indicated that he thought that, you know, this was just teachers' union punting and not wanting to be evaluated. You've got Republican candidate Rob Astorino, who made a bold statement as a parent of younger children saying, my kids are not taking these tests. My kids are opting out. They're going to sit. They're going to, you know, draw pictures or read a book or whatever it is you do when you're not taking the standardized test. And that's something that, you know, Astorino is trying to outflank Cuomo on this issue. And Astorino is trying to harness that unrest, a bipartisan unrest over these tests, and use it as a political issue for himself. And so what we're seeing is, I think we're seeing him move the governor down the field a little bit to play defense on the issue. Exactly what form that's going to take has yet to play out, but I think it's going to be something we're going to be talking about a lot in the coming weeks, and I guess in 12 more weeks until everyone goes home for the summer.
Just about 4 more minutes left on this program, and I wanted to touch on a topic that Rosemary threw our way. And CNN's Piers Morgan signs off with final blast at U.S. gun laws.
It was very interesting. Piers Morgan has been 3.5 years, something like that, on CNN. And,
low rating.
And he's been fired. Low rating. And he's horrible. I am not a fan. He's
don't
rude.
Pull your punches, Rosemary.
He's rude. He's a terrible interviewer. He is. He does not have interesting guests. And yet, on his way out, he hit something that is maybe one of the reasons that he is being fired, aside from low ratings, and that is his incredibly anti-gun remarks and stance. And he said he had no apologies for it. He was right about it. People are dying in the United States. And yes, it's true he's British, but it shows how pro-American he is that he takes this stand. He'd like to see more of us live. It was a pretty strong statement. And it just reminds me how your stance on guns affects all these jobs. The Surgeon General has run into the same problem. He's in trouble getting his job because of the way he feels about guns. What is going on?
And an issue here in Albany at the state capitol as well.
Right.
There was a big rally on Tuesday.
And Astorino, again, looking for that wedge issue.
Looking for the wedge issue. And interestingly, Donald Trump came to Albany for probably the first time in maybe ever. I don't know.
Yes, and he's definitely pro-guns.
Well, he said he's pro-gun, and you know, there was some interesting politicking going on, but it probably largely settled in Astorino's favor, but gun issue doesn't go away. I don't know what big role.
Very much reminds me of where we were with gay marriage a decade ago. It was everywhere. It was interjected into every single debate. Now it's guns. So.
Right.
Carl Paladino made an appearance as well, yes?
That's right. Yeah, yesterday's rally at the Capitol had sort of three machers of New York political Republican life. Astorino, Paladino, and Donald Trump, who I think we should probably modify his name to end in, you know, just
Trumpino.
Trumpino.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, you know, Paladino wants to see Trump run and, you know, really organize this rally. And it was sort of like a Trump for governor rally. And got a pretty good turnout, about 3,500 people, the state police estimate. Organizers had said they'd have more. But I think based on what I saw, I don't see any reason to think the state police were far off. And then Astorino had to speak and sort of, you know, deal with this red meat Republican issue in front of this rally. And he did okay, I thought.
Now, we tried 20 questions last week when I was filling in.
Yes.
We ended up with 5 questions, but we'll do one question. Start with Rosemary and then Jimmy. Does Trump run for governor of New York?
No.
No.
Absolutely not.
Well,
then what's he doing?
He's playing.
What's he doing
he's
in Albany
Trump.
Yesterday?
He loves the theater. He loves the hobnobbing. It's good for his name. Don't forget he makes his money on his name. He's burnishing it.
He also owed Carl Paladino a solid. I think that he and Paladino have actually formed something of a bond over the process of Trump's flirtation with a gubernatorial run, which ended, as we all suspected, with him not running for governor. Right. And so Paladino is trying to make some noise about this draft Trump effort. And I think Trump did him a solid by coming up to Albany, appearing at the rally, and, as you said, burnishes
his own image. If I were Astorino, I would be a little annoyed. He comes into a rally at which Paladino has said, Trump for our next governor. What?
Right. You're absolutely right.
Well, I'm confused. What's
absolutely
in it for Paladino?
Right. It keeps Paladino relevant. It allows him to save face. Paladino, at the beginning of this election cycle, made a lot of noise, tried to tilt the eventual nominee of the Republican Party. And it seems that everyone's moving in the Astorino direction. And Paladino would like to see perhaps some action against the Republican establishment that is lining up behind Astorino.
Well, this was fun. Jimmy Vielkind, Capital New York's Albany Bureau Chief, thank you very much for being here. And Rosemary Armeo, our pal. Well, you know, you did well today. You didn't get...
pal.
You didn't yell.
Pal. Yeah, I got to go think about that.
Caused me any angst. It was very nice, and we appreciate it. If you want to email in on the tepid proceedings you just heard, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Back with hour number two coming up.